Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we cut through the noise and get straight to the insights you need to be truly well-informed.
That's the goal.
Today, we're doing something maybe a little different. We're going to pull back the curtain on a company that has been, well, quite literally, quietly powering the world for almost a century.
Yeah, a real under-the-radar giant in some ways.
Exactly. You might not know its name directly, Genuine Parts Company, but trust me, you definitely know its most famous brand, Napa Auto Parts.
That's right. And imagine this giant, this true distribution behemoth, a dual engine powerhouse, as we're calling it, that's now navigating a period of, well, pretty intense pressure and transformation.
Right.
It's a fascinating and sometimes, you know, kind of complex investment profile. Really showcases the challenges and opportunities in today's global economy.
Absolutely. Our mission today is to do a deep dive into Genuine Parts Company, GPC,
yeah.
A company with a rich history, a truly unique structure, and some very current vulnerabilities that are making waves. We're going to unpack its historical strengths, pinpoint where it's facing its toughest challenges, and examine how it's trying to navigate these massive shifts into incredibly different industries.
And we'll explore why this story, Dividend King, which we'll get into, is currently trading at a discount.
Yes. And maybe more importantly, what that tells us about the future of distribution itself.
We've really pulled together a robust picture for you today, drawing from a whole stack of sources. Comprehensive investment analyses, detailed financial reports directly from GPC, the latest industry market trends, and historical data, too.
So a multi-angle view.
Exactly. Our goal isn't just to inform you, but to help you become genuinely insightful about GPC's journey and what it means for the broader economic landscape. You know, give you that shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Okay, let's unpack this then. When we talk about GPC, we're essentially talking about a global service organization founded way, way back in 1928, almost 100 years ago.
Incredible longevity.
Isn't it? Its fundamental business model is, well, it sounds simple, the distribution of automotive and industrial replacement parts.
Sounds simple, but the scale is immense.
Right, but here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, a bit complex. We like to think of it as that dual engine powerhouse. Why? Because it's essentially operating two very distinct and at times even sort of divergent business segments under one corporate roof.
It's almost like having, I don't know, a reliable, high mileage workhorse engine for one part of the business and maybe a high performance, perhaps more temperamental engine for another.
Yeah, and both trying to drive the same vehicle forward. It's a tricky setup.
It is. And what's fascinating here is how that core identity as a global service organization translates into these two distinct pillars. The larger of these engines, if we stick with our metaphor, is the Automotive Parts Group.
Okay.
This segment, it accounted for approximately 63% of GPC's total net sales in 2024. So the clear majority.
63%. Big chunk.
Huge. And globally, GPC is a leading distributor of automotive replacement parts, accessories, and service items. And, as you noted, the name that's truly ubiquitous, especially in North America, is Napa.
Oh, Napa. Yeah, that's practically synonymous with auto parts here, isn't it? You see those blue and yellow signs absolutely everywhere.
Precisely. And here's a fun fact. Napa, which stands for the National Automotive Parts Association, isn't actually owned outright by GPC in the way you might think.
Oh, really? How does that work?
It's a voluntary trade association that was founded back in 1925, even before GPC, and GPC is its sole member.
Huh. So they're the only member of this association that they don't technically own.
Kind of, yeah. This unique structure has been instrumental in making the Napa brand just absolutely ubiquitous, particularly across North America, where it's deeply ingrained in the automotive repair landscape.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, who are they selling to mostly? You mentioned professionals.
Yes, the customer base for this automotive segment is heavily, heavily weighted towards professional installers, what we call the do-it-for-me, or DIFM market.
DIFM, got it.
Yeah, so think independent repair shops, service stations, car dealerships, fleet operators, places like that. These professionals make up a staggering 80% of GPC's global automotive sales.
80%? Wow. So only 20% is us regular folks walking in off the street, the DIY crowd.
Exactly. The remaining 20% goes to the retail do-it-yourself market.
Yeah.
But it's abundantly clear where their strategic focus and, frankly, where the bulk of their profit comes from.
So 80% to professionals, that's a staggering amount. But what's really keeping them coming back to Napa over, say, just ordering from Amazon or another big chain? Is it purely about speed or is there something else at play?
That's an excellent question, and it really gets to the heart of GPC's competitive advantage in this DIFM segment. For professional installers, time literally is money.
Right, every minute counts.
Every minute that a vehicle is stuck on a lift waiting for a part, that bay isn't generating revenue. I remember seeing a survey where mechanics said their biggest frustration wasn't necessarily the cost of parts, though that matters.
It was the
wait for them.
Yeah.
Exactly. So GPC's value proposition is crystal clear. Rapid parts availability, having a vast selection of inventory close by, and utterly reliable, often multiple times a day, delivery.
Multiple times a day. Wow.
Yeah. They're solving that critical problem of minimizing technician downtime and maximizing vehicle throughput for these shops.
Okay, that makes total sense why 80% of their business is professional. And it's not just North America for automotive, right? They've really gone global.
Indeed. GPC has expanded its automotive footprint significantly through strategic acquisitions, big ones. For example, the Alliance Automotive Group, or AG, acquisition in 2017 gave them a leading presence across Europe.
AG, okay. Where in Europe?
We're talking about them becoming a major player, number one or two, in markets like France and the UK. And then in Australasia, you know, Australia and New Zealand, brands like Repco, which are household names down there.
I've heard of Repco.
Right. They became part of GPC's portfolio with the GPC Asia Pacific acquisition back in 2013. This shows their serious global ambition within that automotive engine.
Okay, so that's the big automotive engine. Now let's talk about that second engine, the industrial parts group. That's about, what, 37% of their sales?
That's right, 37% of 2024 net sales. And it operates primarily under the banner of Motion Industries.
Motion Industries.
Right.
What do they do?
So Motion Industries is a premier North American distributor of maintenance, repair, and operations, MRO products and services.
MRO. So not car parts.
Definitely not car parts. These are the absolutely critical components that keep the wheels of industry turning. We're talking essential items like bearings, mechanical power transmission, fluid power equipment like hydraulics and pneumatics, and increasingly automation solutions.
Okay, so parts for factories, machinery, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. These are the parts that factories, power plants, refineries, huge industrial operations rely on to stay productive.
So just like NEPA keeps garages running, Motion Industries is all about preventing costly downtime, but this time in the industrial sector. The stakes feel even higher there, potentially.
You're absolutely right. For their industrial customers, minimizing operational downtime isn't just a value proposition. It's like an existential necessity sometimes.
Yeah, I bet.
If a massive production line stops because of a broken bearing or a hydraulic failure, the cost can just skyrocket incredibly quickly. We can be talking hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars an hour in lost production in some heavy industries.
Wow.
So Motion Industries provides that rapid access to a vast, specialized inventory of these vital replacement parts. And this segment, too, has grown substantially through strategic acquisitions. The most notable recent one was the $1.3 billion Kaman Distribution Group, or KDG, acquisition in 2022.
KDG, what did that bring them?
That deal significantly expanded Motion industry scale and, importantly, its technical expertise, especially in high-growth areas like automation, fluid power, and power transmission, really cemented their leadership position in North America.
So this company is truly global. We're talking approximately 10,600 locations in 17 countries as of, what, year-end 2022? That's immense.
It's huge. The footprint is massive.
But I'm looking at our sources here, and it seems like their revenue is still, like, really heavily concentrated in North America.
That's correct. And that's an important point. While they have this impressive global reach, North America generated 74%, almost three-quarters of GPC's total revenue in 2024.
74%.
Yeah, with Europe at 16% and Australasia at 10%. This concentration, it really highlights the formidable strength and maturity of their domestic networks, where they've built something truly robust over decades.
But it also kind of suggests there's maybe still a lot of room to grow internationally.
Absolutely. For an astute observer, it whispers of an opportunity, perhaps a significant one, for further international expansion.
Mm.
Imagine the untapped potential in markets where they've only recently established a foothold through those acquisitions like AG.
Right.
What's also fascinating, going back to North America, is the unique structure of their NAPA network here. It's a hybrid system.
A hybrid. How so?
It combines strategically located company-owned stores with a substantial number of independently owned NAPA auto parts stores. As of 2022, the numbers were something like 77 distribution centers, about 1,700 company-owned stores, and a staggering 5,000-plus independently owned stores.
Over 5,000 independent stores. That sounds like a brilliant strategic move. It gives them massive market coverage without having to, foot the bill for all those locations themselves.
Precisely. It's almost like a franchise model, but with deeper operational integration through the distribution centers and the NAPA brand itself.
Yeah.
This hybrid model allows for incredibly extensive market coverage and a strong localized brand presence, all with a lower capital outlay compared to a fully company-owned retail footprint.
And you get the local knowledge too.
Exactly. It
Yeah.
effectively leverages local market knowledge
Right.
and the entrepreneurial drive of independent store owners who are, deeply embedded in their communities. It's a core strategic advantage that has served GPC for decades, building loyalty at both the consumer and professional levels.
Okay. So we've got these two powerful yet very different engines under one hood, the steady automotive aftermarket and the more cyclical industrial side. It sounds like a fantastic diversification play on the surface, a way to spread risk.
It seems like it, yeah.
But is there a downside to this dual engine setup? What are the inherent strengths and maybe the hidden vulnerabilities of having such a diversified business?
This diversification is indeed a strategic strength. The needs-based, less discretionary demand of the automotive aftermarket provides remarkably resilient and stable cash flow.
Right, people need to fix their cars.
Pretty much, yeah. People generally need to fix their cars regardless of the immediate economic climate, making it a defensive business that acts as a vital buffer during broader economic downturns.
Okay.
This is in stark contrast to the industrial group Motion Industries, which, as we discussed, is highly cyclical and directly exposed to the health of the manufacturing and industrial sectors. When factories slow down, so does demand for MRO parts.
Ah, so that's where the dual engine analogy gets a bit more complex. You have one engine that's fairly consistent and reliable, chugging along, and another that's more of a roller coaster tied directly to the ups and downs of the economy.
Exactly. And this inherent structural difference leads to a potential vulnerability, what's often referred to in finance as a conglomerate discount.
Conglomerate discount. Explain that.
Well, it's the idea that the market might value a company with diverse, unrelated businesses at less than the sum of what those businesses might be worth if they were separate, independent companies.
Why would it do that?
Several reasons. Complexity, for one. It's harder for investors to analyze and understand. There can be a perception of inefficiencies, maybe a lack of focus. Managing two fundamentally different businesses with distinct customer bases, supply chains, competitive dynamics, it's just really hard.
So the market thinks maybe management can't be experts at both things simultaneously.
That's often the perception. That lack of perceived synergistic magic, or even just the potential for inefficiencies, often translates into the market valuing the combined entity at less than the sum of its individual parts.
That's a fascinating insight. Can you give us a real-world example of how this might play out with GPC? Did we see this divergence recently?
Certainly. In 2023, we saw a clear divergence where the industrial segment and the international automotive businesses actually outperformed expectations, showing pretty robust growth.
Okay.
However, the core U.S. automotive business was softer, facing some headwinds. This precisely illustrates the challenge. Different parts of the business react differently to market forces, making it harder for a single diversified company to present a clean, consistent growth story to investors.
Got it. And you mentioned they're trying to address this.
Right. To address these very complexities and the associated cost burdens, GPC has introduced an ongoing global restructuring program, which we'll definitely dive into more later. It's their attempt to optimize this dual engine setup and hopefully unlock more value.
Okay, makes sense. Moving on, let's talk about the waves of change and cycles this company is riding, because even a nearly century-old giant like GPC isn't immune to the tectonic shifts happening out there.
No one is really.
Let's pull back the curtain on the industry landscapes they operate in. These aren't static ponds, right? They're oceans with powerful, evolving currents. Let's start with the automotive aftermarket. How big is this market really, and what's fundamentally driving its growth?
A global automotive aftermarket is truly colossal. I mean, the numbers are staggering. Market size estimates vary depending on what you include, but they consistently range from, say, $430 billion to well over $900 billion annually on a global scale.
Wow, billion with a B.
Oh, yeah. The U.S. light-duty aftermarket alone, just passenger cars and light trucks, is projected to be a $405 billion industry for 2024.
400 billion just in the US. That's massive.
It is. And it's not just big, it's also remarkably stable. It's expected to continue growing at a sort of low to mid single-digit compound annual growth rate for the foreseeable future. The underlying demand here is driven primarily by two incredibly consistent, almost geological factors.
Okay, what are they?
First, the aging vehicle fleet. This is a huge one. Consumers, especially in developed markets like the U.S., are holding on to their cars longer than ever before.
I feel like my car is ancient.
Right. The average age of vehicles on the road in the U.S. has been steadily climbing, pushing well past 12 years now. Older cars just naturally accumulate more miles, experience more wear and tear, and inevitably require more repairs and maintenance. This has been a powerful and consistent tailwind for the entire industry.
Okay, older cars need more fixing. Makes sense. What's the second factor?
Second is vehicle miles traveled, or VMT. It's a pretty simple equation. Mm-hmm. The more people drive, the more parts wear out. Brakes, tires, suspension components, you name it.
Right. More driving equals more wear.
Exactly. VMT itself is influenced by a complex interplay of economic conditions, things like gas prices, employment rates, and also evolving societal trends, like the balance between remote work and the return-to-office push we're seeing.
So if we're all driving more, maybe commuting again, and driving older cars, GPC and NAPA benefit, but who are they competing against in this enormous, fragmented market? It sounds like there must be a ton of players.
It's an incredibly competitive and highly fragmented landscape. You have the large national retailers, the household names like AutoZone and O'Reilly Auto Parts. They cater significantly to the DIY crowd, but are increasingly pushing into the professional DIFM space too.
Okay, the big chains.
Then you have major distributors like GPC through NAPA and their big competitor LKQ, who primarily service that professional DIFM channel. And then beneath them, you have literally thousands upon thousands of independent repair shops and smaller local parts distributors.
So a real mix.
A huge mix.
Yeah.
And on top of all that, e-commerce has really shaken things up in recent years. Online platforms, whether it's Amazon or specialized auto parts sites, offer increased price transparency and, let's face it, unparalleled convenience sometimes.
Yeah, click and ship.
Right. Which intensifies the pressure on traditional brick-and-mortar stores like NAPA to justify their existence, often through superior service, immediate availability, and technical expertise. It's a constant battle for market share, where efficiency and speed are absolute king, especially for those professional customers.
That makes perfect sense. Now, switching gears to the industrial MRO market, you mentioned its cyclicality earlier. How much of an economic barometer is this segment, really? Is Motion Industries' performance a genuine reflection of broader economic health?
It's an incredibly reliable one, actually. The industrial distribution market's demand is, well, it's inextricably linked to macroeconomic indicators.
Like what specifically?
Things like overall industrial production, manufacturing output levels, and capacity utilization across various industries. How much of their potential output factories are actually using.
Okay.
When the economy is expanding, factories are running at higher rates, machinery experiences more wear, and the demand for MRO products, those essential replacement parts like bearings and hydraulics, naturally increases.
And the reverse when things slow down?
Precisely. Conversely, during economic contractions or slowdowns, industrial activity cools off, factories might idle lines, and the demand for those MRO parts inevitably declines. So if you're looking for a pretty accurate pulse check on broader economic health, particularly the manufacturing sector, Motion Industries' performance is a solid indicator.
That's useful to know. And is that market also fragmented, like the automotive side? Are there still opportunities for Motion Industries to keep growing through consolidation, buying up smaller players?
Yes, absolutely. Like the automotive aftermarket, the industrial MRO market is large and also highly fragmented. There are numerous smaller regional distributors scattered all over the place.
Ah, so lots of potential targets.
Exactly. This structural characteristic actually presents ongoing and significant opportunities for major players like GPC through Motion Industries to gain market share through strategic acquisitions. They can efficiently roll up these smaller operations, consolidate purchasing power, leverage their vast logistics network that we talked about, and bring greater scale and technical expertise to a wider customer base. It's a tried and true growth strategy for them that still has considerable runway ahead.
Okay, we've covered the current market dynamics for both engines, but there's a massive elephant in the room when we talk about the future of the automotive industry. Electrification.
The big one. EVs.
EVs. You hear these numbers like a potential 60% reduction in maintenance value for EVs compared to gasoline cars. That sounds like a potential doomsday scenario for a traditional parts company like GPC.
Yeah, those headlines are stark.
But you mentioned earlier it's more of a long fuse existential threat. How can GPC possibly navigate such a massive structural change without hemorrhaging revenue? What's the silver lining here, if any, and what does that extended timeline really buy them?
You've hit on perhaps the most significant long-term secular trend impacting the automotive aftermarket. And yes, that 60% reduction figure does sound dire and it absolutely is an existential threat to specific parts of the traditional aftermarket catalog. But the key, as you said, is that long fuse aspect.
Okay, explain the core challenge first. Why fewer parts?
The core challenge lies in the fundamental mechanical simplicity of battery electric vehicles, or BEVs, compared to internal combustion engine ICE vehicles. EVs just have drastically fewer moving parts.
Right. No complex engine, really.
Exactly. They eliminate over 150 component types found in a typical ICE vehicle's engine, its fuel system, and its exhaust system alone. Think about it. Oil filters, fuel filters, spark plugs, ignition coils, mufflers, catalytic converters, they're all gone in a pure BEV.
Wow, 150 distinct parts just vanish from the demand pool. That's a huge chunk of their traditional catalog. It sounds like they're facing a fundamental shift in what they even sell.
It is indeed a fundamental shift. This directly threatens a significant portion of the traditional aftermarket parts catalog, particularly the high-frequency replacement items associated with ICE maintenance. Mm. That research suggesting the value of routine maintenance and parts repair could decline by as much as 60% for an EV compared to an ICE counterpart over its lifetime. That's a stark, undeniable figure that management absolutely has to grapple with.
Okay. So it's a huge challenge, no doubt about it. But you emphasize that it's a gradual shift, not some sudden collapse overnight. How exactly does that long fuse help a company like GPC? What is that extended timeline by them in terms of adaptation?
Crucially, the impact is gradual, which buys them time, precious time. Projections indicate that traditional ICE and hybrid vehicles will still constitute the vast majority, estimates vary, but maybe around 92% of U.S. vehicles in operation as late as 2030.
Still over 90% by 2030. That's longer than I might have thought.
Right. And even beyond that, think about the millions and millions of ICE vehicles already on the road today. They aren't just going to disappear. They'll be driving around needing repairs for decades to come. The average car age keeps going up, remember?
Good point. The existing fleet takes a long time to turn over.
Exactly. This extended timeline provides a long runway for established distributors like GPC to adapt their business models. They can pivot and evolve their inventory, retrain technicians in their networks, adjust their supply chains. It's not an overnight transformation that leaves them stranded. It's more like a slowly turning tide they need to navigate.
That's a crucial distinction. So what are the new opportunities that emerge from this shift for a company like GPC? It can't all be about what they're losing. Surely there are new revenue streams, different parts needed.
Absolutely. The EV transition actually creates new, albeit different, revenue streams. There will be growing demand for EV-specific components. Think high-voltage battery packs, electric motors, sophisticated power control units, specialized cooling systems for the batteries. These are new, complex, often expensive parts that need distribution and repair expertise.
Okay, so new parts categories emerge. Anything else?
Yes, and here's a surprising fact. Some powertrain agnostic parts, parts that both ICE cars and EVs need, might actually see increased demand, or at least different wear patterns.
Like what?
Tires are the classic example. Due to the higher curb weight of EVs because of the heavy batteries and that instant torque they deliver.
Right, they accelerate fast.
Super fast. Their tires tend to experience significantly more wear, maybe around 20% faster, compared to equivalent ICE vehicles.
20% faster tire wear. Wow. That's a significant and often overlooked replacement opportunity right there for GPC's NEPA network, which sells a lot of tires.
Exactly. So for your next tire purchase, whether you're driving an EV or not, you're now armed with a little more insight into those underlying market dynamics driving that sale.
Huh, good to know. And what about the customer base for repairs? Does the increased complexity of EVs change things for the DIY market? Are people still going to try fixing their own electric cars?
It definitely changes the dynamic. The increased complexity, the high voltage systems, the specialized diagnostic tools required for EV repairs, all of that will likely shift more business away from the traditional DIY segment towards the professional DIFM segment.
Yeah, I'm not messing with a 400-volt battery in my garage.
Most people aren't. This could potentially benefit GPC's extensive NAPA Auto Care network of affiliated service centers, as more consumers will likely rely on trained professionals for these specialized repairs. So while it's a structural shift in the types of parts sold, it's also potentially a redistribution of profit pools towards the professional segment that GPC already heavily serves.
Interesting. So maybe less volume overall, but potentially more value captured in the professional channel they dominate.
That's part of the adaptation strategy. The long-term valuation risk for GPC, therefore, isn't necessarily a catastrophic revenue collapse overnight. but rather a potential compression of his valuation multiple, as the market prices in the uncertainty and the execution risk associated with this massive technological pivot. It's all about how well and how quickly they adapt.
Okay, let's turn now to GPC's competitive edge. What gives them a true economic moat, something that makes them incredibly difficult to compete against day to day? I imagine that global scale we talked about earlier is a big part of it.
Absolutely, scale is huge.
But how does that translate into a real, sustainable, competitive advantage?
You're absolutely right to focus on that. GPC's primary economic moat, its enduring competitive advantage, is its unrivaled scale and network density. We talked about the numbers, over 10,000 locations globally, distribution centers, branches, stores. The company has built a logistical infrastructure that is exceptionally difficult and, frankly, astronomically costly for any competitor to replicate from scratch.
Yeah, you can't just snap your fingers and build 10,000 locations.
You really can't. Think about the capital investment alone, the years and years of establishing supplier relationships, securing the real estate in the right places. It's an enormous undertaking that creates a significant barrier to entry, especially at their level of service.
I can definitely see how difficult that would be to build from scratch.
It truly isn't something you conjure up overnight. This extensive, deeply integrated network is the absolute cornerstone of their value proposition, especially for their professional DIFM and industrial MRO customers.
Connect that scale directly to the customer benefit again. Why is it so critical for those pros?
Because for these customers, parts availability and the speed of delivery are absolutely paramount. Remember, any downtime means lost revenue for them. GPC's ability to place a massive, diverse inventory of parts physically close to the customer and deliver them often within hours, sometimes minutes. In dense urban areas with multiple deliveries a day, yes. It enables them to meet those demands for rapid service that competitors with less dense networks simply can't match consistently. This is a critical differentiator in markets where downtime costs are significant, where waiting even a day for a part can mean hundreds or thousands of dollars in lost productivity for their customer. It creates immense stickiness, real loyalty with their professional clients.
Okay, so the scale and logistics are undeniably impressive, a real moat. But what about the Napa brand itself? It's been around for almost a century, so it must have some serious brand strength, right? Everybody knows Napa.
It does. Napa has incredibly strong brand recognition, particularly in North America. It's built over nearly a century, fostering a deep sense of trust among customers, both DIY and professional. When you think auto parts, Napa is probably one of the first names that comes to mind for many people.
For sure. But is brand awareness enough?
Well, here's a potential vulnerability, or at least an area to watch, that's been highlighted in some recent consumer data. While the brand is well known and highly trusted, some surveys show it scores highest on trust.
Which is great.
It is great. But it may actually lag key competitors in overall customer satisfaction related to the store experience itself. A Market Force study, for example, noted that while Napa scored highest in customer trust, AutoZone was actually the market leader in terms of reported store visits and satisfaction with the experience during those visits.
Huh. That's a pretty interesting disconnect, highest trust, but maybe not the best experience. How concerned should GPC be about this? Is this just a minor operational thing, or could it signal a deeper issue?
That's a critical question, and it's something management must be looking at. Other survey data, from Comparably, for instance, has indicated that Napa sometimes ranks behind competitors like O'Reilly Auto Parts, AutoZone, and Advance Auto Parts in customer perceived product quality and overall customer service.
So multiple data points suggesting an issue.
Right. It suggests that brand awareness and trust, while incredibly valuable assets built over decades, don't always automatically translate into a best-in-class customer experience today. It's not necessarily a minor glitch. It points to a potential market share vulnerability.
Because if the experience isn't great.
Exactly. If customers, even loyal professional ones, perceive better service, faster checkout, easier online ordering, or maybe even better perceived quality elsewhere, that trusted brand name alone might not be enough to sustain market leadership indefinitely, especially with nimble online competitors constantly trying to chip away. It's a gap GPC needs to proactively address.
Let's get into some numbers now. How does GPC quantitatively benchmark against its peers in terms of profitability, specifically margins? Because that's ultimately where the rubber meets the road, financially speaking.
Right, let's look at the segments. When we look at the automotive segment for fiscal year 2024, GPC's automotive group reported a 36.9% gross margin and a 7.8% operating margin.
Okay, 37% gross, 8% operating roughly. How does that compare?
Now compare that to its more DIY-focused peers. O'Reilly, for example, had a much higher 51.2% gross margin and a really strong 19.5% operating margin. AutoZone was similar, maybe even slightly better on gross, with a 53.1% gross margin and 20.5% operating margin.
Wow, those are pretty significant differences in margins. O'Reilly and AutoZone are way higher, especially on the operating line. Why such a disparity? What explains that big gap?
This difference is largely, almost entirely, due to GPC's business mix, which we discussed earlier. Their heavier skew towards the lower margin but higher service DIFM channel naturally leads to lower gross margins compared to retailers that focus more on the DIY customer.
Explain that a bit more. Why is DIFM lower margin?
Because servicing professionals requires more cost. You have outside salespeople visiting shops. You have frequent rapid delivery costs. You often need more sophisticated inventory management for specialized parts, maybe more generous return policies, dedicated phone lines. All that adds SG&A cost relative to the sale. A DIR often just walks in, grabs a common part off the shelf, and pays at the counter. It's just a less costly transaction model per dollar of revenue.
Got it. More service equals higher costs, lower operating margins.
Generally, yes. But what's worth highlighting here, and it's an important nuance, is that GPC's automotive operating margin, while lower than the DIY chains, looks pretty healthy compared to other distributors who are also heavily focused on the DIM channel. For example, Advance Auto Parts, another big player trying to serve DIM, actually reported a negative 7.8% operating margin in the same period amid their own struggles.
Ouch, negative margin.
Right. So GPC's positive 7.8% operating margin in automotive suggests they are managing their selling, general, and administrative, or SG&A, expenses quite efficiently given their DIFM-heavy model. They seem to be making the most of their lower gross margins compared to some direct competitors.
Okay, good context. Efficient within their chosen niche. Now, what about the industrial segment? How does Motion Industries stack up against its big rivals in the MRO distribution space like Grainger or Fastenal?
In the industrial segment for fiscal year 2024, Motion Industries posted gross margins of 35.1%, actually pretty similar to the automotive side, and operating margins of 12.9%.
13% operating margin. Better than automotive. How does that compare to peers?
While these are solid competitive margins, they do trail the best-in-class industrial distribution operators. Grainger, for example, had a 39.4% gross margin and a 15.4% operating margin in that period. And Fastenal, which has a somewhat different model focused on vending and on-site solutions, boasts really impressive numbers. 45.1% gross margin and 20.0% operating margin.
Okay, so Motion is competitive, doing well, but clearly behind the leaders like Grainger and especially Fastenal on profitability. There's room to improve there.
Definitely room to grow and optimize, especially on the operating margin front, which suggests potential for efficiency gains or maybe leveraging scale further.
And I imagine that industrial segment's performance really shows its sensitivity to the broader economy, maybe even more directly than the automotive side sometimes.
Absolutely. It's a very clear-cut relationship. We saw that in 2024, the negative comparable revenue growth of 2.1% for GPC's industrial segment vividly underscores its sensitivity to those broader contractionary industrial economic conditions. When manufacturing slowed down, Motion Industries feels it almost immediately. It's a very direct barometer, like we said earlier.
Let's delve into GPC's financial performance over a longer period now, say the last decade, from 2014 to 2024. How has this dual-engine powerhouse actually been performing in terms of growth? And what do the numbers truly tell us about its profitability and efficiency over time?
Okay, looking back over that decade, GPC's top-line revenue has grown substantially, from about $15.3 billion back in 2014 to $23.1 billion in 2023. That's pretty significant growth for an established, mature company.
Yeah, adding almost $8 billion in revenue is not small.
Not at all. However, what's truly fascinating here, and a key insight when you dig into the year-by-year numbers, is that this top-line growth hasn't been a smooth, steady, linear ascent.
Oh, what does it look like?
Instead, you see these significant revenue jumps, almost like stair steps on the chart. For example, there was a big jump in 2018, right after they acquired Alliance Automotive Group in Europe, and then another big jump in 2022, following the Command Distribution Group acquisition for the industrial segment.
Ah, so the big acquisitions really moved the needle on revenue.
Dramatically. This pattern really highlights the company's profound reliance on strategic mergers and acquisitions, M&A, for its top-line expansion. Organic growth, selling more from existing operations while present and important, has generally been more modest, maybe low single digits typically, and often quite susceptible to prevailing economic conditions in its core markets, especially in the industrial side.
So M&A is clearly a central, almost indispensable driver for their overall growth story. What about profitability during this period? Have margins been consistent, or have they too seen some volatility like the revenue?
Profitability has shown a more variable picture, especially when you look at operating margins and the bottom line recently. On the positive side, gross margins have actually shown a steady, commendable improvement over the decade. They've expanded from around 30% back in 2014 to nearly 36% more recently.
That's a good trend. What's driving that gross margin expansion?
It likely reflects several things. A changing business mix, perhaps towards higher value parts or services, the benefits from those key acquisitions that often tie in higher margin private label products or specialized capabilities, and probably effective pricing initiatives over time as well.
Okay, so gross margins up. What about operating margins?
That's where the picture gets cloudier, particularly in the most recent periods. Operating margins have been more volatile. They actually peaked at a pretty healthy 7.6% in 2023, but then, as we touched on earlier, compressed significantly to around the 5.0-5.2% range for the full year 2024 and the trailing 12 months into 2025.
Wow, a drop from 7.6% to around 5%. That's a big hit to profitability.
It is. This recent sharp compression in operating margins is a key area of concern for investors and analysts right now. It's being driven primarily by higher selling, general, and administrative SG&A. Costs like wages, rent, fuel, and also substantial restructuring charges that they've been taking as part of that program we mentioned.
That compression in operating margins sounds like a serious challenge, especially given the rising costs we hear about everywhere. What has that ultimately meant for their bottom line, their earnings per share, or EPS?
The impact on profitability, and thus on their earnings per share, EPS, has been quite sharp and really undeniable, especially in 2024. Reported diluted earnings per share actually fell over 30% in 2024, down to $6.47 from $9.33 in 2023. And that was despite that modest overall revenue growth we talked about.
Down 30%. Ouch. Even with revenue slightly up.
Exactly. That shows you how much pressure those margins were under. Even if you look at their adjusted diluted EPS, which strips out some of those one-time restructuring costs and other items to try and get a clearer picture of core operations. Mm-hmm. Even that still declined by a significant 12.5% in 2024.
Still down double digits on an adjusted basis. That really highlights the pressure they're feeling on core profitability. No wonder the market is paying attention.
Precisely. It's caught the market's attention, and it's a key reason why the stock has been under pressure.
Now, one of GPC's most defining characteristics for investors, and perhaps its greatest source of pride, maybe even a core part of its identity, is its status as a dividend king. Can you explain what that means and how it profoundly shapes their capital allocation strategy? Because it seems to dictate a lot of their financial moves.
Absolutely. Being a dividend king is an elite and incredibly rare status in the investment world. It's a title given to S&P 500 companies that have increased their annual dividend payment for at least 50 consecutive years. GPC has blown past that milestone. They've increased their dividend for an astonishing 69 consecutive years as of 2025.
69 years of dividend increases. That's incredible. Through all kinds of economic weather.
All kinds. Recessions, inflation, market crashes, you name it. This track record is a core appeal for income-oriented investors, providing a reliable and growing income stream. It signals stability and financial discipline.
But does that commitment create limitations?
Yes, and this is a critical point. This unwavering commitment, this near-sacred status, also places a significant, almost non-negotiable demand on its cash flow. The dividend has to be paid, and it has to grow, pretty much regardless of the near-term business environment.
How much cash are we talking about?
For example, in 2024 alone, the company returned a substantial $555 million to shareholders via dividends. This commitment, while a huge draw for a certain type of investor, can create a certain rigidity in how they allocate capital. Essentially, the dividend becomes the first priority, the first claim on cash flow.
So the dividend comes first, almost no matter what. What about other ways they return capital to shareholders, like share repurchases or buybacks?
Share repurchases are definitely a secondary method of capital return for GPC. They tend to use it more opportunistically when there's excess cash flow available after funding the dividend and their necessary investments for growth, including M&A. In 2024, for example, GPC repurchased about $150 million of its stock.
Okay, so less than a third of what they paid in dividends.
Right. But here's the really significant signal of the financial pressure they've been under recently, something that really caught the market's eye. The company actually announced it was pausing its share repurchase program in mid-2025.
Whoa. Pausing buybacks. For a dividend king, that feels like a big deal. What does that tell us?
It tells us they are actively, maybe urgently, conserving cash. It's a relatively rare move for a company so committed to shareholder returns, and it signals that the pressures on profitability and cash flow are real and significant. They needed to preserve flexibility.
A pause in buybacks certainly sends a clear message about financial priorities. So to summarize their capital allocation hierarchy, number one, the dividend is paramount. Got to pay it, got to grow it. Number two is probably investments in the business and strategic M&A for growth. And then number three, only if there's cash left over, maybe share repurchases. Is that a fair assessment?
That's exactly it. Strategic acquisitions remain the primary use of capital for growth, with billions deployed over the past decade to expand their reach and capabilities. But that recent pause in buybacks, coupled with the revised downward cash flow guidance they issued for 2025, signals what we might call a capital allocation squeeze.
A squeeze, meaning not enough cash to comfortably do everything they want.
Pretty much. With profitability under pressure from inflation and softer markets, with significant restructuring costs to fund, and with that dividend commitment being essentially immovable, management had to pull the most flexible capital return lever available to them, which was the buyback. This highlights the financial constraints the company is currently operating under and raises questions about its capacity to fund large-scale M&A in the near term without potentially taking on additional leverage. It's a really delicate balancing act right now.
It sounds like they're in a bit of a tight spot, financially speaking, trying to juggle all those priorities. Let's shift our focus now specifically to GPC's growth and strategy, especially that relentless M&A engine we keep mentioning. You said acquisitions have been central, but just how core has that been since the beginning?
Growth through consolidation has truly been GPC's central pillar, not just for the last decade, but really since its inception way back in 1928. They've consistently operated in these highly fragmented markets, both automotive and industrial, where there are just tons of smaller, independent players ripe for consolidation.
So it's in their DNA.
It's deeply ingrained in their corporate DNA. Their strategy has always been to identify, acquire, and efficiently integrate these smaller, often regional distributors into their vast network, leveraging their scale, purchasing power, and operational expertise. This strategy remains absolutely core to their approach today.
Can you give us a few standout examples of those key transactions over the last decade or so that really illustrate the strategy in action and show the kind of impact they had?
Certainly. We mentioned a couple already, but let's recap the big ones for impact. In 2013, the acquisition of GPC Asia Pacific, which was formerly the Exego Group, was a major strategic expansion into the Australasian automotive aftermarket. That gave them a strong foothold with brands like Repco in Australia and New Zealand.
Okay, entry into Asia Pacific.
Then, in 2017, they made that truly transformative $2 billion deal to acquire Alliance Automotive Group, or AG. This was huge. It established a major, even leading presence for GPC in the very large European automotive market. We're talking about acquiring the number one distributor in France and number two in the UK overnight. Massive scale jump.
$2 billion. That's a big bet.
A very big bet. Pivotal for their international automotive strategy. Also around that same time frame, starting in 2017 and concluding in 2019, they acquired the Inenco Group, which was a leading industrial distributor in Australasia. This was strategically interesting because it created a dual automotive and industrial presence for them in that region, mirroring their North American structure.
Ah, so they were building out both engines globally, not just automotive, essentially replicating their North American model in other key geographies.
Exactly. They clearly see value in that dual engine approach internationally as well. And then more recently in 2022, the $1.3 billion acquisition of Cummins Distribution Group, or KDG, was another major scale-enhancing move, this time for the industrial parts group, Motion Industries, significantly strengthening their position in those key areas like power transmission, automation, and fluid power in North America.
Okay. And are they still doing deals now, even with the squeeze?
Yes. Though perhaps smaller bolt-on deals seem more likely given the capital constraints. Just last year, in May 2024, they continued their core North American consolidation by acquiring the largest NAPA independent store owner group in the U.S. That deal brought nearly 100 NAPA auto parts stores and 5 distribution centers under GPC's direct ownership. So these aren't just one-off deals. They are part of a continuous strategic effort to consolidate fragmented markets, even their own network.
It's clear that M&A is their bread and butter for growth. But what about other avenues for growth beyond just buying up other companies? Are there other levers they can pull, especially given that capital allocation squeeze we discussed? They can't just rely on big deals forever, can they?
That's a great point. No, they can't solely rely on M&A, especially large M&A right now. While continued bolt-on acquisitions in fragmented global markets likely remain a long runway, GPC is also focusing on several other growth levers.
Like what?
Well, one is leveraging its existing substantial international platforms, AG in Europe and GPC Asia Pacific, to drive further consolidation and, importantly, organic growth within those regions. They're not just acquiring, they're trying to optimize and expand their existing operations there, maybe gain share organically.
Okay, grow what they already own internationally.
Right. They're also prioritizing the expansion of their higher margin private label offerings. This is a big focus across the board. This isn't just about slapping a Napa sticker on any generic part. It involves working directly with manufacturers to source components that meet their specific quality standards, often at a lower cost to GPC, which significantly boosts those crucial gross margins we talked about.
Better margins on their own brands. Makes sense.
Exactly. And imagine the power of rolling out the Napa brand, already a powerhouse in North America, more strongly across Europe and Australasia, through the AG and Repco networks. Building that global brand recognition for their own products is a significant play for future organic growth and profitability.
So their own brands could become a bigger, more profitable part of the mix globally. What about technology in the supply chain itself? Given all the shifts we've talked about with e-commerce and efficiency pressures, that seems like a critical area.
That's absolutely critical, yes. Continued aggressive investment in modern e-commerce platforms, advanced data analytics, and supply chain automation is not just nice to have, it's essential for them.
Why so essential now?
Because these investments are key to enhancing operational efficiency, taking costs out to be improving the customer experience, hopefully addressing some of those satisfaction gaps we mentioned earlier, and fundamentally competing effectively against both traditional rivals and that ever-growing army of online challengers. It's about optimizing their existing operations, reducing costs, meeting modern customer demands for digital interaction, and ensuring they remain relevant and competitive in a world that's increasingly digital first, even for auto and industrial parts.
Now let's talk about the more immediate challenges. You mentioned earlier that GPC has been facing some significant headwinds in that capital allocation squeeze. How has their performance actually been under pressure over the last couple of years, say specifically from 2022 through 2024? What do the numbers tell us about this apparent deceleration?
Well, after a period of relatively robust performance, maybe benefiting from some post-pandemic tailwinds like supply chain disruptions favoring incumbents, GPC has indeed experienced a sharp and frankly concerning deceleration more recently.
How sharp?
If you contrast 2023, which actually saw pretty strong sales growth of 4.5% and a healthy 12.3% increase in diluted EPS with 2024, well, 2024 is a very different story. Full year sales grew a mere 1.7%. And even that small growth was primarily driven by acquisitions, meaning organic sales were likely flat or down.
Okay, so top line stalled out organically. What about profits?
That's where it really hit. As we discussed, reported net income fell a dramatic 31.3% in 2024, down to $904 million. And diluted EPS dropped significantly to $6.47 from $9.33 in 2023. Even on that adjusted basis, diluted EPS still declined by 12.5%.
That's a truly significant drop in profitability across the board. Has that challenging trend continued into 2025, or have they started to show signs of turning the corner?
Unfortunately, the pressures have persisted into 2025. The company reported second quarter 2025 results that included another year-over-year decline in adjusted EPS, down 14% this time.
Still double-digit declines.
Yes. And as a direct consequence of this continued pressure and maybe a less optimistic outlook for the second half of the year, management had to revise its full-year 2025 guidance downward. They're now projecting total sales growth of only 1% to 3% for the full year and adjusted diluted EPS in the range of $7.15 to $8.
Which is way down from where they were a couple of years ago.
Way down from the $9.33 they hit in 2023. This indicates that the challenges are proving stubborn and the recovery path is perhaps more difficult or taking longer than initially anticipated.
Okay, so profitability is clearly under significant pressure. What are the key challenges that management has specifically identified as the causes of these headwinds? What's going on beneath the surface that's driving these disappointing results?
Management has been quite transparent about these pressures, and they generally cite a confluence of factors hitting them simultaneously. Firstly, cost inflation has been a persistent and pervasive issue across the business.
Inflation hitting everyone, right?
Exactly. In their 2024 10K filings and subsequent earnings calls, they've repeatedly pointed to rising costs, particularly in personnel, think higher wages, benefits, training costs, and also escalating rent expenses for their thousands of locations. These have directly driven up their SG&A expenses.
And squeezing margins.
Squeezing margins significantly. Mm-hmm. In fact, they noted that SG&A inflation actually outpaced their sales inflation in Q2 2025, which highlights a structural issue where their operating costs are growing faster than their top-line revenue. That's unsustainable.
Yeah, that's a recipe for margin compression right there. Expenses growing faster than sales. What else are they seeing impacting the business?
Secondly, they're facing softer end markets in certain areas. The industrial segment, as we discussed, its cyclical nature, has been experiencing contractionary market conditions. Comparable sales declined 1.7% Q4 2024, reflecting that broader slowdown in manufacturing activity.
Okay, industrial weakness. What about automotive?
On the automotive side, while generally more resilient overall, management has noted seeing a cautious end consumer. That might indicate a pullback in more discretionary spending on vehicle maintenance or upgrades, maybe people deferring non-essential repairs. And thirdly, there have been some supply chain and inventory issues they've had to deal with.
Like what?
Well, the company incurred a significant inventory-related charge in Q4 2024. They said it was part of a strategic realignment of its tools and equipment strategy, basically writing down inventory they decided wasn't core anymore. While positioned as strategic, it points to the inherent complexities of potential inefficiencies in managing such a vast and diverse inventory across thousands of locations globally. Getting that wrong can be costly.
So, a triple whammy, really. Cost inflation, softer demand in key markets, and some internal inventory challenges. That's a lot to contend with all at once. How is management responding to all of this? What's their strategic counterpunch to try and restore profitability?
Their primary and most critical response is that comprehensive global restructuring program, which they initially announced in 2024 and then notably expanded in scope and expected cost in 2025.
Why expand it? Things were worse than they thought.
That's the likely interpretation. This isn't just some proactive continuous improvement measure. It feels like a critical and necessary response to realign their assets and cost structure with the current, more challenging economic reality. The sharp deterioration in profitability in 2024, despite relatively flat sales, clearly indicated that their operating cost base was simply too high, not aligned with the prevailing inflationary environment and softer demand. They needed to act decisively and maybe more deeply than first planned.
Okay, so it's a reaction to the pressure. What's the scope of this restructuring and what are they hoping to achieve in terms of actual cost savings? It sounds like a pretty big and probably painful undertaking.
It is indeed a major undertaking. They're now expecting to incur total costs for this program of somewhere between $150 million and $180 million in 2025 alone. That's a lot of restructuring charges hitting the income statement.
And what's the payoff they're aiming for?
The goal is ambitious: to achieve approximately $100 million to $125 million of additional savings in 2025 from the expanded plan, on top of any savings from the initial phase. The bigger target is a total annualized run rate savings of approximately $200 million by the time the program is fully implemented in 2026.
$200 million a year in savings, that's substantial. How will they get there?
It likely involves significant operational changes across the board. Things like optimizing their distribution network, maybe closing or consolidating some facilities, streamlining back office functions, potentially reducing headcount where necessary through attrition or layoffs, and improving procurement practices to get better prices from suppliers. It touches everything.
That's a huge target for savings. So it seems like the successful execution of this plan and actually realizing those cost savings are absolutely critical for GPC's financial future in the near term, right? It sounds like the most important thing for them to get right now.
Precisely. The successful and timely execution of this restructuring plan and the realization of those targeted $200 million in annualized cost savings represent, without a doubt, the most significant near-term catalyst for the company's financial performance and stock price. It's essentially a make-or-break initiative over the next year or two to restore their operating margins, protect earnings, and reestablish a pathway to more sustainable, profitable growth. Investors will be scrutinizing every update on this front incredibly closely.
Okay, let's talk about management quality and then valuation. Given all these moving parts and significant challenges, the dual engines, the long-term EV threat, the current restructuring, is GPC a potential bargain, a deal hiding in plain sight? Or is it more of a distraction, maybe even a value trap for investors right now? First, how do we assess the leadership team navigating this?
Well, GPC's management team is generally viewed as being composed of seasoned executives with deep experience in the distribution industry, which is certainly crucial for navigating the complexities of their vast supply chains and customer relationships.
Any recent changes at the top?
Yes. There was a notable leadership transition in 2024. Will Stengel took over as CEO from the long-serving Paul Donahue, who transitioned to the role of executive chairman. Stengel isn't an outsider, though. He previously served as president and COO, so his promotion represents strategic continuity rather than some radical shift in direction, which is often seen as reassuring during a period of transformation like this. The team has a long history of successfully integrating acquisitions and managing complex global operations, demonstrating a generally steady hand over the years.
And what about their communication with the investment community during these tougher times? Are they transparent about the challenges, or do they tend to sugarcoat things?
I'd say they generally maintain a high standard of communication and transparency, which is commendable, especially given the current headwinds they're facing. The company provides pretty detailed financial information, including segment-level performance data in its quarterly earnings releases and its SEC filings like the 10K and 10Q.
And they explain the adjustments.
Yes. Importantly, management also offers clear reconciliations of non-GAAP financial measures, things like adjusted net income, adjusted EPS, and free cash flow back to their corresponding GAAP measures. This level of detail helps investors better understand the underlying performance of the core business and dissect the impact of those significant restructuring charges and other one-off items. That transparency is absolutely essential when a company is facing significant pressures and undergoing major changes.
Okay, good to know they're upfront. Moving on to valuation then, the big question. How does GPC stack up against its peers right now, and what does its current stock price tell us about the market's perception of its future prospects?
This is where the deal or distraction debate really comes into focus. GPC generally trades at a noticeable discount compared to the premier operators in both of its main segments.
How much of a discount?
For instance, looking at recent numbers, its trailing 12-month price-to-earnings, or TTMPE, ratio was around 24.0. Its enterprise value to EBITDA, or EBITDA multiple, was about 13.8. Now compare this to the automotive retail leaders. O'Reilly Auto Parts had a TTMPE closer to 36.5, and AutoZone was around 27.5.
Okay, significantly lower PE than AutoZone, and especially O'Reilly. What about the industrial side?
Similar story there. Compared to industrial distribution leaders, Grainger's TTMPE was around 25.7, slightly higher than GPC's, and Fastenal was way up there with a TTMPE of 46.6. So GPC is trading at lower multiples than the top dogs in both its key markets.
So a clear, noticeable discount compared to those top-tier players across the board. What are the primary reasons the market seems to be assigning this lower valuation?
It likely reflects several interconnected factors that we've discussed. First, GPC's inherently lower overall margins due to that heavy DIFM business mix in automotive. Second, the recent earnings decline and the ongoing profitability pressures from inflation and the restructuring. Third, that long-term EV threat to its core automotive business definitely casts a shadow over future growth prospects. And fourth, the inherent complexities of its conglomerate dual engine structure, which, as we talked about with the conglomerate discount, can make it harder for the market to value efficiently or maybe leads investors to demand a higher margin of safety.
Okay, so reasons for the discount relative to peers. But how does its current valuation compare to its own history? Is it cheap relative to where GPC itself has historically traded?
That's another interesting angle. Compared to its own history, GPC actually appears relatively inexpensive right now. Its current TTMPE ratio of approximately 24 is noticeably below its 10-year historical average PE, which is closer to 27.5.
Ah, so below its own average.
Yes. This suggests that the stock's valuation multiple has compressed significantly, likely in direct response to those recent operational headwinds, the earnings decline we saw in 2024, and the revised downward forward guidance for 2025. So, from a purely historical perspective, you could argue it's trading at a discount to itself.
And its dividend yield. For a dividend king, what does that signal to investors right now? Is a higher yield necessarily a good sign here, or could it be a warning?
For a mature, stable company like GPC, the dividend yield can be a very useful indicator, especially for income-oriented investors. As of late 2025, its forward dividend yield was hovering around 2.96%.
Almost 3%. How does that compare historically for them?
That's actually higher than its five-year average yield, which was closer to 2.7%. Now, a dividend yield that is elevated relative to its historical average can sometimes suggest that the stock price is undervalued, implying the market is overly pessimistic.
But there's a catch.
The big catch, the assumption, is that the dividend itself remains secure, and the company's long-term growth prospects haven't fundamentally deteriorated. If the dividend is safe and likely to keep growing, then a higher starting yield means you're getting more income for your investment dollar, which looks attractive. But if the high yield reflects underlying business risk that could threaten future dividend growth or even the dividend itself, then it's potentially a warning sign, a yield trap.
That's a fascinating point about the dividend yield potentially signaling undervaluation if it's sustainable. And you mentioned the conglomerate discount earlier. How does that factor into a potential sum of the parts assessment where you might try to value each segment individually?
Right. A conceptual sum of the parts or SOTP analysis is relevant here. It basically asks, what would the automotive business be worth on its own? And what would the industrial business be worth on its own based on peer valuations? The fact that GPC, as a combined entity, trades at a discount to the premier pure play companies in both sectors suggests that this conglomerate discount may indeed be applied by the market.
So the whole is worth less than the sum of its parts in the market's eyes?
Potentially, yes. The pure play leaders like O'Reilly in auto or Fastenal and Grainger in industrial command premium valuation multiples because of their focused operations, higher margins, and clearer growth stories. GPC, as this blended, diversified entity, gets assigned a lower multiple overall. This implies the market may not be fully valuing the individual strengths and potential of each segment, possibly due to the complexities, maybe concerns about capital allocation efficiency between the two, or just that lack of a simple narrative. It's a complex puzzle for investors to try and piece together and decide if that discount is justified or represents an opportunity.
All right, before we wrap up with the bull and bear cases, let's talk explicitly about the risks. Because no investment is without them, and GPC clearly has its share right now. What are the key risks investors should be watching out for? Maybe break them down into business risks and financial risks.
Okay, good idea. There's several categories of risks to consider, and they are quite significant for GPC at this juncture. On the business side, first, there's that inherent cyclicality of the industrial segment, Motion Industries. It's highly sensitive to economic downturns, manufacturing slowdowns, and changes in capital expenditure by its customers. That can create earnings volatility.
Okay, cyclicality is one.
Second, the long-term technological disruption from the EV transition poses what some might call an existential threat to a significant portion of their traditional automotive parts revenue streams over the next 1 to 2 decades. Successfully navigating that requires massive adaptation and investment, and the outcome isn't guaranteed.
The EV threat is huge. What else on the business side?
And third, in both markets, they face intense competition. From large national chains like AutoZone and O'Reilly, from other major distributors like LKQ, from smaller independent players, and increasingly from nimble online retailers like Amazon Business or specialized parts websites. This constant competitive pressure impacts pricing power and market share.
Those are some big structural business risks. What about the financial risks that could impact their ability to weather these challenges or execute their strategy?
Financially, there are a few key areas. First, debt and leverage. GPC has historically used debt, often significantly, to finance its acquisition strategy. Its total debt-to-equity ratio was recently around 137%, which is somewhat elevated, though perhaps not unmanageable for a company generating its level of cash flow. While their interest coverage is currently healthy, this level of leverage could become a concern during a prolonged economic downturn or if interest rates stay persistently high, increasing interest expense.
Okay, leverage is one to watch. What else financially?
Second, distribution is a very working capital intensive business. Just think about all the inventory they have to hold across 10,000 locations. Merchandise inventories represent a huge portion of their assets. There's a constant risk of inventory obsolescence, especially with rapidly changing technology like EVs, and managing working capital efficiently is critical for cash flow. We saw that recently cash flow from operations actually declined in the first half of 2025, partly due to unfavorable changes in working capital, including inventory.
So managing inventory and cash is crucial.
Absolutely. And related to that is the risk of overall cash flow volatility. This can be driven by the industrial segment's cyclicality, the significant cash required for M&A when they do deals, and the cash needed for big initiatives like the current restructuring program. That pause in the buyback program was a direct result of needing to manage cash flow carefully.
And lastly, in terms of execution, what are the specific risks around management's ability to actually navigate all of this successfully and achieve their strategic goals, especially the restructuring?
There are definitely execution risks. GPC's growth strategy has relied so heavily on M&A, so there's always the inherent risk involved in successfully integrating acquired businesses, realizing the projected cost savings or revenue synergies, and preventing key talent from leaving the acquired company. Integration is hard work.
True. And the restructuring.
But perhaps the most critical execution risk right now is the global restructuring plan itself. There's a significant risk that the company may not achieve its ambitious targeted savings of approximately $200 million annualized. Or, alternatively, the costs required to achieve these savings could end up exceeding the current estimates of $150 to $180 million, which would eat into the net benefit. The successful, efficient execution of this plan, hitting those targets on time and on budget, is absolutely paramount for their near-term financial health and credibility with investors. If they falter here, it could significantly deepen the financial pressures and further weigh on the stock.
We've covered a lot of ground today, really peeling back the layers of Genuine Parts Company. Let's pull it all together now. What's the big picture summary for our listeners? The bull case versus the bear case for GPC right now? And maybe most importantly, what are the absolutely critical factors they should monitor going forward to see how this plays out?
Okay, let's synthesize. If you're a bull on GPC, your investment thesis probably centers on its identity as a resilient, diversified distribution leader that is currently trading at a discount relative to both its peers and its own historical valuation.
So value proposition is key for the bulls.
Yes, combined with resilience. The defensive nature of the automotive aftermarket, driven by that non-discretionary need for repairs and the constantly aging vehicle fleet, provides a remarkably stable and predictable source of cash flow, a real anchor for the business.
And that cash flow supports.
That cash flow, crucially, underpins GPC's coveted Dividend King status, offering investors that reliable and consistently growing income stream that has proven incredibly resilient through numerous economic cycles over nearly seven decades. For income investors, that's a huge draw.
So a stable core business providing reliable income, a real defensive anchor. What else makes a bull optimistic about GPC's future, especially given the current challenges?
Well, the ongoing global restructuring program presents a clear and quantifiable catalyst for margin expansion and earnings recovery over the next, say, 12 to 24 months. If they execute successfully, hitting that $200 million savings target could significantly boost profitability from current depressed levels.
The turnaround potential.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Furthermore, the company's formidable scale and dense distribution network constitute a durable competitive moat that is incredibly difficult and costly for competitors to breach, especially in those service-intensive professional channels where they dominate. That moat isn't going away.
Scale is enduring.
And finally, the fragmented nature of its global end markets, particularly in industrial MRO and international automotive distribution, still provides a long runway for continued growth through its proven strategy of bolt-on and sometimes strategic acquisitions. They have a playbook for consolidation that generally works, and there are still plenty of targets out there.
That's a pretty compelling case for the bulls, highlighting a durable business with a strong income profile, a clear catalyst for recovery, a solid moat, and continued growth avenues. But what about the bear case? Where do the skeptics see the vulnerabilities and the reasons for that persistent valuation discount?
The bearish perspective tends to focus on GPC as a complex conglomerate facing a difficult confluence of headwinds that the bears argue justly justify its discounted valuation, making it potentially a value trap.
What are the main points for the bears?
First, the industrial parts group is highly susceptible to economic cycles and appears to be navigating a period of softer demand right now, which will likely continue to weigh on overall growth and profitability for a while. Second, and perhaps more critically for the long term, the automotive parts group faces that undeniable secular decline in some of its most profitable traditional product categories due to the inexorable shift to electric vehicles. Bears believe this structural headwind will likely continue to suppress the company's valuation multiple over time, as the market prices in that future revenue risk and the uncertainty of their adaptation.
So, cyclical headwinds now, secular headwinds later. What about the recent financial performance we discussed, that margin compression and earnings decline? That must be a major pillar of the bear case.
Absolutely. Recent financial results show clear, hard evidence of margin compression from rising operating costs outpacing sales growth. And the success of that multi-year costly restructuring plan needed to fix it is, frankly, by no means guaranteed.
Yeah.
Execution risks are high.
And the dividend commitment, bears see that differently.
Yes. Bears might argue that the company's rigid commitment to its dividend, while appealing to income investors in the short term, significantly constrains its capital allocation flexibility during a critical period of transformation. It forced them to pause share repurchases and potentially limits their capacity for larger, perhaps necessary, strategic M&A or technology investments without taking on additional, maybe risky debt. It creates inflexibility when they need flexibility most.
Makes sense. Any other points for the bears?
Finally, despite its scale and brand trust, the data suggests the company's automotive brands, particularly NAPA, appear to lag key competitors in crucial customer satisfaction metrics related to the store experience. Bears worry this could signal potential market share vulnerability that might erode its competitive position over time if not addressed effectively, especially as competitors improve and online options proliferate.
Okay, so compelling arguments on both sides. For our listener trying to make sense of all this, what are the truly critical factors they should keep an eye on? The things that will tell them whether the bull case or the bear case is playing out, what should be on their personal monitoring checklist when they look at GPC going forward?
Great question. I think there are four truly critical factors to monitor closely. First, and maybe most importantly for organic health, pay close attention to comparable sales growth or comp sales.
Why comps specifically?
Because this strips out the impact of acquisitions and tells you how the underlying business is performing. You want to see a return to positive comparable sales growth in the industrial segment, signaling a cyclical recovery is taking hold. And you want to see sustained resilience, ideally with at least low positive organic growth in the automotive segment, demonstrating its ability to hold up against competitive pressures and the early effects of the EV transition. Negative comps persisting would be a bad sign.
Got it. Watch comparable sales growth for both engines. What's next on the checklist?
Second, pay very close attention to adjusted operating margins, or you could use adjusted EBITDA margins. They tell a similar story. The trajectory of segment and consolidated margins will be the most direct real-time measure of whether that massive restructuring program is actually succeeding.
What are you looking for?
You want to see clear sequential and year-over-year improvement in those adjusted margins. That would confirm that the cost-saving initiatives are effectively offsetting inflationary pressures and truly improving underlying efficiency. If those margins stagnate, or worse, continue to decline after all this effort, it's a major red flag about the restructuring's effectiveness.
That's the proof in the pudding for the restructuring, right?
Yeah.
If the margins aren't moving up, the plan isn't delivering as intended.
Exactly. Third, keep a very sharp eye on free cash flow generation.
Yeah.
This is absolutely crucial for assessing GPC's ability to sustainably fund its cherished dividend, to reinvest adequately in the business for future growth and adaptation, like EV capabilities or technology, and eventually, if conditions allow, to resume those share repurchases.
What specifically about free cash flow?
Pay particular attention to how they manage working capital, especially inventory levels and accounts receivable. Poor working capital management can significantly drain cash flow, even if earnings look okay, as we saw hints of recently. Consistent, healthy free cash flow generation is vital for their model.
Makes sense. Cash is king. And finally, what should they listen for when management speaks on earnings calls or at investor presentations? What are the key phrases or updates that might signal meaningful shifts?
Fourth, and this is vital, you need to scrutinize management commentary very carefully. Future earnings calls and investor presentations will provide crucial updates on the restructuring timeline and, critically, whether they're actually realizing the targeted savings they promised. Listen carefully for their updated outlook on industrial end markets. Are they seeing green shoots or continued caution? And listen for any shifts in capital allocation priorities, especially any commentary regarding the potential timing or conditions for resuming that share buyback program. Those details will offer crucial insights into their confidence, their adaptability, their execution capabilities, and their future strategy in what remains a very complex and evolving landscape for them.
Well, we've certainly taken a deep dive into Genuine Parts Company today. We've revealed, I think, a remarkably durable business with an incredible history, a true dividend king that is simultaneously trying to balance that legacy with the intense immediate pressures of cost inflation and softer markets, alongside the huge long-term structural challenge of technological disruption from EVs. It's really a compelling case study of how even established giants must constantly adapt, innovate, and at times undergo painful restructuring just to remain relevant and successful.
Absolutely. And for you, the learner, trying to understand these market forces, GPC isn't just about one company's stock. It's about seeing how all these diverse economic forces, everything from the average age of vehicles on the road to the accelerating pace of electrification, from global supply chain costs and inflation to the subtle nuances of customer satisfaction and brand loyalty, how they all play out in the real world for a large, complex, essential enterprise. It really highlights the profound complexities of business strategy and valuation in times of significant multifaceted change.
It truly does. So here's a provocative thought for you to mull over as we wrap up. What does GPC's unwavering commitment to its Dividend King status, even when facing significant financial pressures that force it to pause share buybacks and undertake major restructuring, tell us about the priorities of mature companies today? And what does it tell us about the expectations of their long-term investors in this rapidly changing world?
And maybe how might this delicate balance, this tightrope walk between delivering immediate shareholder returns through dividends and strategically future-proofing the business for decades to come, how might that balance need to evolve as the EV transition inevitably accelerates and those industrial cycles continue to turn? It's a fascinating challenge with no easy answers.
Excellent questions to ponder indeed. The choices GPC makes today navigating these cross currents will undoubtedly define its next chapter, maybe even its next century.
It will be fascinating to watch.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We hope you feel genuinely insightful about this fascinating company and the broader forces shaking its future. We'll catch you next time.